We left off on Daf Yutesima Beis last time, and we had just completed a little bit of the discussion, not the, the first part of the discussion, of the idea that Kavod HaBrios doesn't trump all. The Gemara had said that if someone finds, he discovers in the middle of his of the shuk that his beged has kilayim, then he has to strip it off right there, and he can't wait. You know, he can't continue to wear it until he gets to a more private place. And this is assumed to only apply to kilayim d'oraisa. This does not apply to kilayim d'rabbanan, because we're going to see kilayim, the kavod habrios is pushes aside many semi-sum d'rabbanan. Let me frame it that way. I think it's worth, I sort of touched upon this last time, but before moving further in the Gemara, I wanted to just focus a little bit on what the kavod habrios is. Because it's a topic that's gotten a lot of play recently, but I think in a distorted way. So I think the best, when you look at the examples in Chazal, in Shulchan Aruch of kavod habrios relates to what I would call, the translation is often human dignity, but it's assumed to be, I would almost call it what is a universal standard human dignity? So I think that there are two particular times that human beings are vulnerable, and I suspect this is across cultures. One is in the context of relieving themselves, of using the bathroom, and the other is in the context of being unclothed. Like, those are sort of universal standards. Everybody, you know, has their likes and their dislikes. Every culture is different than its own. But I think that those two are probably essentially universal. There's a sense of shame that's associated with my finding myself in a circumstance that is socially abnormal, right? So generally speaking, it is mostly assumed in our society, for most of us, when we walk around, we wear clothing, right? We would be humiliated, embarrassed if we somehow, you know, it's the standard anxiety dream, right? That we all at least had when we were kids. I don't know, you know, that you went to school and you realized you were only in your underwear, right? That's the standard anxiety dream. But the fact that that is what you're, you know, the way the surah, the anxiety tells you something about our, it is natural, or as the Torah says, before the achet in Gan Eden, vayushtem arumim ha'adam v'shto v'lo yisposhashu, but subsequent to that, when people are find themselves unclothed, it is embarrassing. And the same thing is true with the person who can't. The Gemara has in Shabbos and a number, and once again, this appears in Shulchan Aruch, a person can't clean themselves properly at the bathroom. You know, again, these are all natural phenomena to human beings, but it's still, there's somehow a sense of shame associated with it if you can't adhere to societal norms. So it's in these cases that Chazal talk about a kavod habrios being, that's what they call kavod habrios. It's a sense of what I would say shame and embarrassment. It's not something I don't like. It's not something I have objections to for whatever particular reason, a personal preference, an ideological preference. Kavod habrios is a sense of shame, of social shame. So the first case we saw, someone finds their kilayim and have to strip down your begadim is very strange. I would note, by the way, it's a very strange, it would seem very strange, hamotzei kilayim bebigdo bashuk. Someone finds, all of a sudden, in the middle of the shuk, I start looking, what's in my jacket here? Oh, it looks like some, how would I know it was shatnez anyway? I don't know. There is actually one very easy case to come up with. It doesn't really matter to us, it doesn't exist for us, where a person could wind up in the shuk with kilayim and being caught off guard, even though it's not odd, which is, today we don't wear, we don't normally wear four-cornered garments. When we wear a talis katan or a talis gadol, these are not standard garments in our society. We wear them so that we can do the mitzvah. Right? That's it. So what happens to be the halacha is, so we don't walk around, you know, if I took off my tzitzis, any garment that had tzitzis, you wouldn't even know the difference. You wouldn't even know the difference. But once upon a time, people's garments were very commonly four-cornered garments. So you might have had your outer garment was actually four-cornered. You needed tzitzis on it. And here's the catch. Supposing you were very fancy. You wore a linen garment. You were a high-end garment. So what do you do with a four-cornered linen garment? Well, in the days that there was tchelas, you would put tchelas on it. You put four strings in each corner in a double to get eight. Some Rishonim say two of the four strings were tcheles. Some Rishonim say one, and one, the Rambam says half a string. What is the definition of tcheles? Tcheles means wool, a wool string dyed with the dye of Yerkes trunculus, or whatever exactly the name of the snail is. Like, in order to be treles, it's not dyeing my silk tie treles. It's not dyeing my linen shirt treles. It means wool. So whenever you have a linen garment in Minat Torah, you put treles on it, you have shatnez by definition. Right? And it's mutter. It's mutter because Chazal tell us that aseh is docha los aseh, that one pasuk says, lo silbash shatnez semer ufishtim yachtav. And the very next pasuk says, this is in Parshas Ekev, Parshas Kisese, excuse me. Yibilim taselach alarbach kanfos kisusaha asher tachaseba, that you have to make a dilim. So from the juxtaposition of the two psukim, from the smichos apsukim, Chazal, the Gemara Yivamos, and elsewhere says that that we learn the principle that aseh is docha los aseh, that a positive commandment and a negative commandment that come into conflict with one another, and there's no way around it. You either have to do the aseh and violate los aseh, or you have to not do the aseh in order to violate, in order to avoid violating the los aseh. So the halacha says, in many cases, aseh docha los aseh. So the halacha would be me'ikar hadin, it may be a machlokas be'shamah be'shelo, but really, if you have a four-cornered, you have a talus that's made of linen, you would put chelas on it. Meaning you would be wearing shatnez. And that's mutter. But here's the catch. What happens, you walk in the shuk, and all of a sudden your garment catches on something, and it tears. And it tears one corner off. And now you have a three-cornered garment, which has treles on it, it's linen. You're now wearing a garment of shatnez, and there's no mitzvah anymore. So the answer is, now you got to strip off the garment. It's a similar issue, by the way, when it comes to Shabbos and an Eruv. This could really happen, actually. You don't need treles and you don't need shatnez. If you're walking in a place that there's no Eruv, and your tzitzis, something happens to your tzitzis, your talus, you have to take it off right then. Because otherwise, it's considered carrying. Because normally, most of us, we don't normally put strings on the end of our garment. So it's considered a burden. It's considered a masal. And you've learned Mishnah and Shabbos. So you know, with things that you can go out with, you can't go out when you're carrying something. So if you're mekayim the mitzvah of tzitzis, so then all the tzitzis are essentially part of the garment. But as soon as the tzitzis is pasul, so then it's no longer, the remaining three things hanging on your garment are considered a carrying, it's a burden, and that you have to take the garment off right then. And in fact, somewhat interesting, this is, I think, only briskers hold this way, but there's a machlokas in the Mishnah. If you don't have treles, whether you can fulfill the mitzvah of tzitzis, whether the lavan and the treles in your garment, the two sets of strings, whether the absence of treles prevents you from doing the mitzvah. Rabbi Yehuda, I believe, says, if there's no treles, there's no mitzvah. You're not allowed, you don't put on tzitzis on a four-cornered garment. You just can't do the mitzvah. So because of that, the briskers, I believe, don't wear tzitzis on Shabbos outside since according to Rabbi Yehuda, you're not yotzei the mitzvah tzitzis without treles, even if you put tzitzis the way we put tzitzis on our garments. So it's all four strings are considered extraneous carrying, and therefore I believe they don't wear tzitzis on Shabbos, certainly in a place where there's no air, right? Maybe in shul, they'll put on a talus, but they won't walk out wearing a talus kafan. That's not the minhag of most people. We assume that the Torah, I believe the Shulchan Aruch Paskim explicitly, even if you don't have treles, there's still a mitzvah tzitzis, and therefore it's not a problem. And as a result, walking out on Shabbos with a garment that is proper, has proper tzitzis, is considered acceptable. But anyway, going back to our case, you could wind up with kilayim in your beged and having to strip it off in the shuk if it was your tzitzis on a garment that all of a sudden became nifsal, and now it's just shatnez, and there's no mitzvah of tzitzis to serve as the permission for the shatnez. Okay, so anyway, so now coming back to our Gemara and Daf Yud Testament days, we are now on the last word on the seventh line. So the Gemara had made the claim that whenever there's chilul Hashem, which can mean the violation of God's word, it doesn't mean just a shanda, but when there's chilul Hashem, when there's a violation of nisu daraisa, in chachma, v'in tfuna, v'in etzel l'neged Hashem. And therefore, if someone finds kilayim in their beged, they have to strip it off even in the shuk. So now, at the end of the seventh line, the Gemara challenges this. Is this really true that kavod abrios loses whenever you have a Torah prohibition, a violation? Mesedeh, kavru es hames v'chazurim. They buried a person, they buried a deceased, and now they're returning to the place where they're going to be menachem me'avelim. Like today we usually do the shura in the cemetery. Okay, although today even, I don't know how common it is, I guess close friends often come back with the Avelin to their house where they begin to sit Shiva. The close friends might participate in the Sudas Havra with the Avelin. When they give the Avelin, they give the mourners the first the Suda, which is supposed to be given from others, not supposed to be from the Avelin's food, from the mourner's food. So they're accompanying the Avelin, the mourners, back from the cemetery.
How far down on the page?
Yud Chesam Beis. We're on end of the seventh line, which is where it began. Meisve. Tabur Asa Meisve Chazra. Ulefnehem Beis Drachen. So we're talking about right now a Kohen. A Kohen, he went to the Levaya, but obviously he didn't go into the cemetery. And now he's accompanying them back. And now there are two streets, two paths that the mourners can take. One is Tahora, Achas Torah, Achas Tmeah. One of them is perfectly pure. There's no concern of Tumas Meis walking on that road. But the other one, there is a concern of Tumas Meis, and you're talking about a Kohen here. So now the question is, the Kohen wants to fulfill the mitzvah of Nichum Avelim, which is a kind of Kavod Habrios. And yet, he's got a choice, right? And what happens if the mourners should choose? The mourners aren't Kohanim, let's say. So they choose to walk on Tamei Street as opposed to Tahor Street. And now the question is, what does the Kohen do? He's got to choose between two things. So the Braisa says, above it Tahora, if the mourners follow the Tahorut, in Imo. Okay, so they follow him. Betorah. Bobitmea, what if they go on the Tamei route? Also, Boin Imo Bitmea, Mishum Kvodo. Right? So the mourner shouldn't be left alone. He should have a sense that people have abandoned him. Therefore, you, the Kohen, can go on the Tmeya route. Amai, says the Gemara, Leima in Chachma Ventuna, Veneta, Leneger Hashem. Right? It's very nice that the mourner is going to feel bad, right? That somehow he's not being afforded the normal course of things, the normal sensitivity. There's a sense of shame. Nobody comes with me. They abandon me. They leave me alone. But it entails violating a Kohen can't be metame to a mace. Lenefesh lo yitama be'amav. It's a very serious aveira. Chiluk kahuna, chiluk kedushas kahuna, profaning a Kohen sanctity. So why are they allowed to come on the tame route? So the Gemara answers, Tirgama Rabbi Abba, the Beis HaPrasta Rabbana. Rabbi Abba said that we're talking about something that is Tamei Meis, only Midrabbanan, is referred to as a Beis HaPras. The Mishnayis, I believe, in the 18th, the final parak of Maseches Aholos, which is the second Masechta in Seder Taras. So the Mishnayis there actually talk about, I think, three kinds of things. Might be three kinds of Beis HaPras, but we usually talk about two. The third one is a different kind of thing. And the two kinds of Beis HaPras that we talk about are, number one, not the one that's being spoken about here, is known as a Sadeh She'ovad Bokever, a field in which you know that somewhere in the field there was a mace was buried, but we don't know where anymore. So most of the field is Tahar. You walk in any given spot in the field, the assumption would be, well, you're probably tar, because you're probably not standing on top of where the mace was. And again, you probably also don't know if the mace is totally decomposed. You don't know what tumah is left. That's one kind of Beis HaPras, which is the Rabbanan. Here they're talking about a different kind of Beis HaPras, a Sadeh Shenechrash Bokever, a field which had a grave, and obviously they didn't bury the body that deep. They buried it in a fairly shallow grave. And then the plows came and plowed up the entire field. Now, the concern is, in this case, that the grave got plowed up. And therefore, the mace at this point, probably mace might have already been decomposed, might have just been bones. And the Maharesha, which with its blades, probably broke up the bones of the mace. Now, if you saw the bones of the mace, obviously they would be tameh, and you would remove them, or you would, you know, and for proper reburial. But the concern made the Rabbanan of a Beis HaPras, this kind of Beis HaPras, a field in which there was a grave that got plowed through. The concern is that there was a little bone, an etzem kisaora, it's really small, like the size of a barley corn, that got dragged around by the machresha that you don't see. It got dragged around by the plow. Now, the halacha is that when you have a bone that's very, very small, if it is smaller than a barley corn, there's no tumah associated with it. But once the bone is the size of a seora, etzem kisaora, unless until it gets to a fairly sizable amount of bones, The halacha is that that bone is not metame if you're in the same under the same roof with it. It's not metame. It doesn't defile the ohel if you're under a common roof, or if you, there are actually two kinds of ohel. The standard kind of ohel of defiling oneself with an ohel, with a tent, we normally think the common contemporary situation is you're under the same roof as a dead body, as a dead person. There's another kind of ohel, which is we can be out in the open air. There's no roof. But if this is the mace and I stick my hand or any part of my body on top of the mace, the term of the mace goes up and down, straight up covering the volume of the mace. We're going to actually talk about this more in the next piece in the Gemara. It goes straight up and down. If there's no roof and you have something, let's say you have a whole limb of a mace sitting on the field, you look at the airspace directly above the limb all the way up to the heavens, at least to the clouds, it's summit, and all the way down to the ground if it's suspended in air. And maybe even to the underground, it could actually have an impact as well. It's what we call tuma boka'as viola u'boka'as viyoredes. The tuma can penetrate going upward and penetrate going downward. Now, what that means then, so that would be a concern if the bone were large enough. But you look around the field and you can see if there's a skull and crossbones there, you know to avoid it. The problem is that an etzim kisaora, once a bone reaches the size of a barley corn from a mace, it now is mitame, it conveys tuma if you touch it or if you carry it. Now, carrying could mean if I kick it and I cause it to move, that's a form of carrying. Now, even though I'm wearing a shoe, so I don't touch the bone directly. So that is the concern that they Chachamim had, that when you plowed up the field, the bones weren't totally broken up. And on the field, there's an etzim kisaora, and now you walk through it. You're a kohen. The concern is tumas mace for a kohen. You walk through the field, and now you are a masjid. You move, which is a form of carrying. You move this etzim kisaora. So the Gemara says, Rabbi Abba said that what is the situation where the mourners are going on a path that's tame, and the kohen is allowed to follow them by a beis hapras the rabbana. By a beis hapras, by this, in other words, means they're walking through a field. The mourner chose to go to his house via the field, which was a beis hapras. So since the tuma associated with a beis hapras is only rabbinic in nature, therefore, the Chachamim say that kavod habrios, the kavod of the avel, pushes aside that concern. And then the Gemara explains one of the other leniencies that we have associated with the Beis HaPras, which is the Amar Rabbi Huda Amar Shmuel menapeach adam Beis HaPras v'holech. So Rashi explains that let's say a person has to go to the Beis HaMikdash in order to bring their Karban Pesach. But there's one minor problem. The minor problem is that what stands between them and the Beis HaMikdash is a Beis HaPras. If only that should be the only thing that stood between us and the Beis HaMikdash. I can't get to the Beis HaMikdash to bring my Karban Pesach because between me and the Beis HaMikdash is a Beis HaPras. So it's a din de rabbanon, what do you do? So the Chacham said, in such a case, a person can be menapeach a Beis HaPras. You can get down with, I guess, your feather, and you get down and you go to the first place in the Beis HaPras you want to walk, and you blow. You menapeach, you blow. Maybe today we would bring like a fan. We would bring one of these, I don't know. They probably don't have these in on the Upper East Side. I'm pretty sure they don't. You get different kinds of noise than I get in Teaneck. The Upper East Side, you get a lot of blaring sirens, horns, cars. In Teaneck, we get leaf blowers. Okay, so you bring yourself a leaf blower, okay, and you designate the path that you want to walk through the Beis HaPras. And you blow, and it blows the dirt away. And if there's an asset, it might blow the etzim kisaora away as well, which is fine. But the dirt is much lighter, and it might be if there's an etzim kisaora, you see, there's a bone. Watch out, don't touch it. So the halacha is, in order to go bring my Karban Pesach for Osei Pesach, as Rashi explains, a person can be menapeach. They can blow the dirt, the dust on the Beis HaPras, thereby exposing any bones. Thereby, they can avoid the tumah. So only if ordinarily a Kohen can do that. Like if a Kohen wants to go eat Truma, then his Truma is on the other side of the Beis HaPras. He's not allowed to do that. But for a Karban Pesach, you can be Minapecha Beis HaPras. You can blow to discover the Tumah. And if the Avelim, I don't even sure you have to be menapeh by the aveilim, because it probably would take too long. But for the aveilim, because tumas beis apras is only the rabbanon, therefore they allowed a kohen to go on the beis apras, if that's the route that the mourners took because of kavod of the aveilim. Okay.
Rabbi Weider, you're touching on an issue that's very, very important, not exactly because of what we're learning in the Gemara, but on this issue of a beis hapras, and even a minute amount of bone could cause tumah. So this is what they faced in Israel very often. When they want to build someplace, and there's some kind of chashash that that place was a place where bodies were buried many, many years before.
Right. So that they do encounter that frequently, and it often makes the news because of certain people who wish to protest. But there is additional challenge. The concern, I think, is not just tumah for the kohanim, because that you can address. If you find bones, you move them. The concern is that if something was actually a cemetery and the mace was buried there intentionally, it's usher to use that space. So that makes it even more challenging. So that's why the protesters, I will refrain from attaching any adjectives to them. But there are many people, even not the protesters, who have an unusual interest in kvaros. In the land of Israel. It is not my particular brand of religion, but they're very, very focused on lots of people like to visit Kvaros. So anyway.
But Rabbi, isn't the body buried in the field of the Pras Hasada, isn't that intentional? I mean, nobody gets buried by themselves, so somebody intended to put that one body in the field.
Yes, but it has to be someone who was buried with Rishus. In other words, if you bury a body in my backyard, we don't say it's now a cemetery. It has to be a place that the mace was buried with permission. The only exception to that rule, and the concern when the Mishnayos and Baba Basra, for example, talk about where are the Mishnayos? I think Baba Basra? No, they're not. The way you dug graves and the spacing was in Baba Basra. I'm trying to remember where the discussion, if you find one grave, well, was it somebody just randomly buried a body in the field, or was this actually a cemetery? And they're all dinim for determining how many graves do you find? Did we say now there's an indication this was actually a cemetery, and you're not allowed to move the bodies? But if someone would have buried a body in your field, and no clear indication of any kind of authorization, and you discover the body can be exhumed and moved. Because the only exception to that rule was one of the takanos of Yoshua ben Nun, which was a mace mitzvah kona mekoma. In other words, if a mace died somewhere and there was no one, and they have the status of a mace mitzvah, which we're going to talk about on the bottom of this amud, so then a mace mitzvah is kona mekoma. And the Gemara in Baba Kama at the end of the seventh parak talks about what happens if you find a mace in the middle of the highway. If you bury the mace there, so we don't assume he's kona his makom on the highway, you have to move him off to one side. But that side becomes the grave, so that grave cannot be exhumed. So the key Lenny is it has to be brishos. It has to be buried where the mace was entitled to be buried there. So with the exception of mace mitzvah, if it's on private property that wasn't a cemetery, then almost definitionally the body could be moved. Right? The problem in modern day Israel is that we don't know where all the cemeteries were once upon a time. So when you find a bone, does that mean there was a cemetery here, or it was just some guy who died and they dumped his body, and this is where it got buried. Okay. So now the Gemara adds another detail also. Not only can someone who's going to bring his carbon Pesach go through the Beis HaPras by using his leaf blower, but for Amar Rav Yehuda Barash Mishmei Derav, Beis HaPras Shenidash is Tahor. If the Beis HaPras has been so thoroughly trampled by foot traffic of people, over a certain amount of time, I don't know how much time that is, then we assume it's tar. We assume that any etzem kisaora would either have been pulverized or basically have disappeared at that point, and we're not concerned about someone walking through. So bottom line is the Gemara's solution to this brisa of a kohen being allowed to follow the aveilim through a place that's tameh is a beis hapras, which is only the rabban. Okay. Now, The Gemara continues. Tashma. Amar Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok. Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok was a Kohen. Medalgen hayinu al gabe arona shomesim. Likros malchei Yisrael. V'lo likros malchei Yisrael bovar amr. Ela afil likros malchei Akum. Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok said, it's very, very strange. I don't know who the Malchei Yisrael were, unless these were Hasmoneans. I'm not really sure. He said, we would jump on Aronos. We would jump across coffins in order to fulfill the mitzvah of greeting a king, Jewish kings. And not only Jewish kings, but we would do this for non-Jewish kings. Why? She'im yizkeh, if a person would merit, yavchen be Malchei Yisrael Malchei Achim, he would appreciate. He would appreciate, we will appreciation the difference between Jewish kings and non-Jewish kings. It's kind of interesting, halacha. Like, what exactly is the mitzvah of greeting a king? Rashi says it's kavod habrios. And Barilas Bar Tzadok says not only that, but it's very strange. You would say that greeting Malchei Achim would be a good reason, A, because it's kavod to the king and then he'll be nice to you. But no, it's because you'll appreciate what Malchei Yisrael are. They weren't, Malchei Yisrael weren't always so good, but I would like to suggest also that there's another element here, which is I was in Camp Stone for the last couple of weeks. So one of the topics that I taught at Sevet was talking about Jewish forms of government, and is there an ideal Jewish form of government, or if we like democracy. And I always ask the students, given your choices, would you prefer to live in a democracy, a dictatorship? It could be benevolent or in a monarchy. Some of the students said, well, it depends who the monarch or the king were. If they were the monarch or the king, they might like that. But I think generally most of us prefer, for all its flaws and the quote attributed to Churchill, even though he probably didn't say it, which democracy is an awful form of government that every other form tried is worse. So we like democracy. We like the idea, as apparently someone who had defected from North Korea said recently, criticizing certain people complaining about the United States, which is you get in the United States, the president's motorcade can drive by and you can write and hold up the most obnoxious, vulgar signs directed at the president of the United States. And that's one of the great freedoms in this country. In North Korea, you'd be dead and your family would be in prison if you tried doing that. So one of the things that we have that sense that we can say whatever we want about President Biden or Vice President Harris or any other elected official, any other, we can say whatever we want, right? Which we do appreciate that. I wouldn't say a downside to it, but, and I'm sure everybody looks at who's probably met a few presidents, despite the fact that you can say whatever you want, usually when you go meet the president, you show a great degree of respect.
Definitely, but I
think that one of the things that we lose, because I'm not advocating for monarchy. Don't get me. Please do not misunderstand me or misquote me. But when you don't have that sense of a monarch and the power of a monarch, you also lose the possibility of appreciating the malchus, the kingship of Melech Malchei Melachim of the Ribono Shel Olam. Right? We don't have sort of a Kein Dugma Shel Mala, an example of the heavenly, malchus. In the malchus below, right? If we live with a melech, we live with certain kind of fear of a melech, right? That a mori b'malchus can be put to death, right? You can't speak disrespectfully to a king. Perhaps it would give us a little more sense of malchus shamayim. But instead, at least in the temporal realms, we live with an egalitarianism where no one is above our opinions. So we don't quite maybe have the full appreciation of the Ribon Shalom of his malchus, right? We talk about a melech, tell Ram ben Isa, but we don't really understand. If you don't live with a monarch, you don't really understand what Malchus is. Okay. Anyway, so there's this idea going to greet the Melech, and Sir Rabbi Elazar bar Tzadok, who was a Kohen, said, we would skip over Arona Shalmesim in order to greet them. So the Gemara says, Amai, Lema in Chachma vein Tzuna, Neinit Tzunagar Hashem. How can a Kohen be jumping on Aronos? It's such a funny expression. It's almost like they were dancing on Aronos. You have a field full of coffins, and they're just running on top of these aronos, hopping from one to the other, in order to get to greet the king. So the question is, how are they allowed to do that? Now, here's an important question that we have to ask, which is, if you jump on top of an aron, are you tameh? Yeah, obviously we're assuming
you're making an ohel over the.
So first I'm going to start with an assumption that there's a body in the coffin. That's a reasonable assumption, although it could almost be irrelevant when we explore Tosas. But let's assume there's a body in the coffin, and therefore when you're on top of the mace, you're metame the ohel. But here's the catch. The catch is, let's say there is a mace inside the chapel at KJ. Maybe I don't know if that's a good example. Okay, are there any rooms on top of not the chapel, the sanctuary? Are there rooms if you go up above the ceiling? There are, right? There are floors above.
Yes, sure.
So that's not that's not an example. Let's just keep a simple example. You go to my shul that I daven in Tina, congregation Minat Yisrael. We have a nice tall ceiling in the main sanctuary. If you were to drill through, go right above that, you'd be standing on the roof. No rooms in between. Okay. So let's say there's a funeral going on. There's a coffin inside the sanctuary. And I am standing on the roof. I went up. I'm not, involved with it. I was going to that funeral. I climbed the roof. I want to check some maintenance stuff out on the roof. Am I coming? And the answer is, generally speaking, no, I'm not coming. Why? The answer is because when there's a mace under the roof of the sanctuary, the roof does two things. The roof does two things. Number one is, imagine the tumah of a mace, the impurity of the mace, like it being a little like the ketores going up. It ascends straight up, and then it hits the roof. And what does it do? Well, it spreads out. So function number one of an ohel, of the roof, is that it spreads the tumah underneath the entire roof. Let's say it's assuming the doors are closed within that room. But there's another function of an ohel. That's, by the way, called mevi es hatumah. It brings tumah to its entire space. But an ohel often does another thing. It's chotzeitz b'fnei hatumah. It serves as chatzitza, as a block. So there, when you talk about most ohelim that we encounter, our roofs, our buildings, something that's attached to the ground, we say that the ohel typically is mevi es hatumah and is chotzeitz b'fnei hatumah. It does both. It spreads out the tumah underneath, but it also serves as a block. So when I'm standing on the roof of the sanctuary, while there's a body inside the sanctuary, a dead person said, I'm taller. Because if I was standing underneath the roof, not directly on top of the body, I'm tummy. That's what a roof does. Now, we're going to talk a little bit more about that, but for the moment, a mace is in, now, let me give you one more detail. Sometimes a roof neither distributes the tumah nor blocks the tumah. An example of that is something that's called, I mentioned this a little bit before, but not exactly the same thing. It's called tuma ritsutsa. Supposing I have a very, very, it's not a room that a person could go in. Supposing I have a little crawl space underneath my roof. It's like a mini attic below the roof. And let's say that crawl space is less than a tefach tall. It's like, 3 inches, okay, empty space, an air space between, let's say, the top of the sanctuary and the roof. So imagine you have this small empty space, less than a poseach tefach, less than a tefach. And then there is a kezias, min hames. There's a dead person, a flesh, a kezias, tiny, you don't need, kezias, very small, olive size. In that genet space, a rodent took some flesh and left it in that space. What is the halacha here? The halacha is when a tumah is in a space that is less than a tefach in terms of the height, we say that the tumah is boka'as viola, boka'as vioredet. If the roof cannot spread out the tumah, so if I were to, let's say, this crawl space is open on either side and I stick my finger in, I'm taho. We don't say that the tumah spread out underneath the entire roof of the crawl space. But if I am standing above, pretend for the moment that there's no, forget the room underneath. I'm standing above, straight above that tumah in the crawl space, I'm tummy. Because the tumah, because there's no ohel to spread it out, the ohel also doesn't block it. The tumah penetrates right through my roof. And if I'm standing right on top of the tumah, I'm now tummy. So sometimes, there are other kinds of cases as well. I'll explain in a moment the third case. But often, we say that a roof is maybe Esatoma and Chotzeit. It spreads it out, but it also blocks. And sometimes a roof is not maybe Esatoma and not Chotzeit. It can't spread the Toma out, but it can't block it either. And then there's the worst of all worlds. Sometimes you have a roof, which is maybe Esatoma, but it's not Chotzeit. And here, the common situation of such a roof, of such an ohel, is an ohel that's tameh. An ohel that's tameh. Now, again, the roof of my shul, or the roof of the sanctuary in KJ, or the roof of the building, is not tameh. It's attached to the ground. But supposing I took a metal tray. If I took a metal tray, let's just do this experiment here. I go outside, okay, in the open air. I take four poles, let's say, four things that I make the metal tray stand on. And there's more than a tefach space between the metal tray and the ground. And now I take a piece of a body and I put it underneath that metal tray. Now, what happens there is that the metal tray is an ohel. There's more than a tefach space between the piece of the mace and the metal tray. So therefore, the metal tray spreads the tuma out. It's maybe a satuma. But because the metal tray is mekabel tuma, it itself is susceptible to receiving tuma, it doesn't block the tuma. So this is the worst, literally the worst of everything. The tuma first spreads out underneath the metal tray. And now, because the metal tray can't block it, if you are anywhere in the world above that metal tray, not just above where the piece of the mace is, you are tuma. Because first the oil spread the tumah, and then it failed to block it. So the tumah goes right through the oil and up. So that's called maybe a satumah, but eno chotzeit. It spreads the tumah out, but it cannot block the tumah from going further. Now, let's talk about a coffin for a moment. The Gemara is asking a question about a coffin. Let's assume for the moment, this is tricky, let's assume a coffin is not mekabel tuma. Now that's complicated for us because our coffins probably are mekabel tuma because they are basically receptacles made of wood. And if I have a single flat piece of wood, at least min haTorah, it's not mekabel tuma. It's not susceptible to becoming tuma. Wood has to have an inside. It has to have something that it contains in order to be something which can become tummy. So let's assume that I don't know what their coffins were, but let's pretend that a coffin, that Aron that they're talking about, let's say it was made of stone. It'd be pretty heavy, but a stone sarcophagus. Stone is not mekabel tuma. No matter, not even the drabanim. No matter what you do with stone, stone's not mekabel tuma. That's why in the archaeological digs, they always find, they say, this was a Kohen's house because they found stone cannon. Okay. Now, I have a stone coffin. The coffin's not mekabel tuma. So let's start with the following assumption. How tall is this coffin? Or put differently, how much space is there between the top of the body and the roof? If there is less than a tefach of space between the body and the roof, then what's going to happen is the tuma is going to go right through the roof. Even though it's not mekabel tuma, it's stone. Because if you don't have a poseach tefach, a tefach gap between the tumah and the roof, the tumah penetrates straight through Bakasa. So if these coffins, these aronos, these sarcophagi, if they had no tefach between the mace and the roof, and the kohanim are jumping across them, inevitably they're going to become tameh midoraisa. It's inevitable. You can't avoid that. So that was what the Gemara's question was. The Gemara's answer was the following. Kid Rava. The Amar Rava, Dvar Torah, Ohel, Kol Sheyeshvo Cholol Tefach, Chotzeit B'Fnei HaToma. Torah law, and this is true even normally mid the Rabbana, if you have a Cholol Tefach, an empty space of a Tefach between the Tumas Mace and the roof is chotzeit b'fnei tuma. It blocks the tuma. Tuma doesn't get above the roof. The she'ein bo cholol tefach, if it doesn't have a gap of a tefach, eino chotzeit b'fnei tuma. Then it would be chotzeit. The rov aronos yesh b'hem cholol tefach. Most arons have a tefach space between the top of the mace and the top of the coffin. I suspect that's true with our coffins as well. For most coffins and most people buried in them, the airspace between, there's at least a tefach space, which is not a whole lot. It's maybe 3.5-4 inches tops, between the top of the body and the top of the coffin. Isaac, you can correct me if I'm wrong. That's my sense. Maybe I'm totally wrong, but.
Yeah, for the most part, you're right. Correct. Unless, unfortunately, it's a very big body.
Okay. So in at least the time of Chazal, and maybe today as well, Rov Aronos, you have a tefach. But, so why are you not allowed to jump on top of Aronos? So the answer is, V'gazru asha yesh bahem, mishem she'en bahem. The Chachamim made a gzera, that a Kohen is not allowed to walk on top of Aronos, because some of them won't have a tefach, and even though a majority do, and therefore you should be able to follow a majority, the Chachamim made a gzera not to do so. But, umishem kavod v'lochem, lo gazru v'rabban, because of kavod for the kings, for respect for a king, that people should show respect for a king, the Chachamim did not institute their decree, their gezerah, in a case of someone who's going in order to greet kings. Okay. Now, this is raises some significant complications. The question is, Tosus asks a question. The Gemara says elsewhere, Rashi quotes this in Chumash, based upon the pasuk, v'chol asher yiga al pinei hasodeh, on the surface of the field. This is in beginning of Parashas Chukas, where it talks about tuma related to a dead body and the paraduma, the parasha paraduma. So based upon those words, v'chol asher yiga al pinei hasodeh, on the face of the field, the Gemara says, L'rabos golel v'dofik, that among the things that normally what conveys impurity, ritual impurity of a dead body, part of a body, a whole body, a certain amount of flesh from the body, certain bones from the body, that's called the tumas guf of the mace. But sometimes there are other things that also convey tumah, and one of them is a golel v'dofik. Golel means literally something that rolls, and dofek means something that bangs. The question is, what is a golel v'dofek? And this became a big machlokas amongst the Rishonim, and its ramifications are actually enormous for Kohanim, having nothing to do with coffins or golel v'dofek. And let me explain. Rashi says that, not here, elsewhere, Rashi says that a golel and a dofek are, the golel is the coffin, and the dofek is the lid that knocks, that bangs when you close it. That's what Rashi says. So Tosos, Rabbeinu Tam disagrees with Rashi based upon number of Gemaras, but that's Rashi's Shita. So Tosos here and elsewhere asks a question. I understand that the lid of the coffin blocks the tumah of the mace getting through, because most coffins have a tefach space between the top of the mace and the top of the coffin. So the roof of the coffin is an ohel. It spreads the tumah out underneath itself, but it can't penetrate through the roof of the coffin. But Tosa says, if the coffin is what's called a golel, or the roof is called a dofek, and a golel of a dofek are metame, I believe, in touching and an ohel, then how could the Kohanim walk on top of the aronos? Even if the Aron has a tefach airspace and the roof prevents the tumah of the mace itself, the Aron itself is tumas mace. V'chol asher yigal, can I ask that there? And that may be true even when you remove the body, maybe. So how could they dance? How could they run across the tops of Aronos? That's the question Tosus asks. And Tosus gives an unbelievable answer. If you take a look, in the top Tosfos, but let's go to the end of the third line. It's Tosfos, I just explained the question. Tosfos says the Yesh Lomar, the Lo Kasha. There's no problem. The Hot Tanya B'Smachos, Masecha Smachos.
Rabbi, where are you?
In the top Tosfos on your Tesama days. End of the third line. The Yesh Lomar.
Got it.
Masecha Smachos is not one of the 63 Masechtos in Shas of Mishnayos. There are a bunch of what they call Masechtas Zutos, little Masechtas, not all of them are so little, that were not canonized as part of the Mishnah. A lot of their materials, not, I don't know, a significant part of the materials are brought in places in Shas as Brises. These are not official Mishnayos. Our knowledge, by the way, so much of our knowledge of many of the halachos that relate to our liturgy is from a small Masechta, which isn't small, called Maseches Sofrim. So you have, if you look in the Vilna Shas, in the standard printed Vilna Shas, in the back of Seder Nezikin, where they print Maseches Avos and they print Maseches Edios, they also print the Maseches Zutos. So there's a Maseches Zuta called either Maseches Machos, or the Gemara refers to it actually as Avel Rabasi. It's about Avelus, it's about mourning. So Tosas says that there's a Braisa in Maseches Machos that says the last fourth line in Tosas, the last wide line in Tosas. Kol toma she'ein ha-nazir megaleach aleha, ein kohen muzar aleha. Here's the rule. There are two people, and we're going to see this not today, but later on our Amud, God willing, next week. There are two people in the Torah who are prohibited from defiling themselves to a mace. Number one is a kohen, and a kohen gadol has even more restrictions than a regular kohen. That's one. Two is a nazir. A nazir is like a Kohen Gadol in terms of his or her prohibition of Tumah, right? A Kohen Gadol cannot be metame to his relatives, neither can a nazir or a nazira. Now, the Mishnayis, and what happens if a nazir becomes tame by accident? Torah says, Nebuch, too bad, but you're tame. You got to shave off all your hair. You got to bring karbanas, and you got to start your naziris all over again. You lose all your first days. Now, what happens if a nazir touches a sheretz? So there's no issue in touching a sheretz, and he just keeps counting his naziris. That's not a problem. The Mishnah, the Mishnayos and the naziris, however, tell us something even more novel. It is not always the case that if a nazir becomes tamei tumas meis, that he has to shave everything off and start over. It appears that only certain tumos, mostly tumos that are directly of the body of the mace, that a nazir, if he becomes tameh, has to shave his head and start all over again. Other kinds of tumas mace that are not the gufo shel mace, not the actual body, but more derivative. So a nazir does not have to restart his naziris. He doesn't have to shave, bring karbanos, and so on. The Mishnah in Smachos, it doesn't say this anywhere in the Talmud Bavli, but the Mishnah in Smachos says that kol toma she'ein ha-nazir megaleach aleha, ein kohen muzar aleha. The Mishnah suggests, the Braisa in Smachos suggests that if it's the kind of tumah that a nazir doesn't have to restart his naziris, then a kohen is allowed to be metame to that. And Tosfos says, the goal of the dofek in nazir megaleach aleim kibitzam b'maseches nazir perikon gadol. The Mishnah says in Maseches Nazir explicitly that a nazir who came in contact with a golel and a dofek does not have to restart his naziris. Hence, Tosfos says, a kohen can dance all he likes at any time, assuming there's no body there, on top of an empty coffin, a golel of a dofek, even though it was used already, because a kohen is not muzar on any tumas meis, where a nazir wouldn't have to restart his naziris. Okay, so that's Tosfos' answer here, and then Tosfos talks about what Rabbeinu Tam thinks a golel v'dofek is. Maybe afterwards I'll tell you what I think a golel v'dofek is, and I think one of the Rishonim says this. But I want to make a very important observation. I'm holding a watch here. You can see my watch. I have some news for everybody. This watch is almost certainly, according to most Rishonim, an Avi Avos Hatama. This watch defiles a person. It is currently defiling me. I'm not a Kohen. It is defiling me, Tomas Mace, right now, as if I were touching a dead body. What am I talking about? Some of you are thinking this man has gone out of his mind. This is what's known as Cherev Harehu Kachalal. The way all Rishonim say is that if you have a metal kli, and my watch is made of metal, that comes in contact with a dead person, I've gone to funerals wearing this watch. So I've been under the same roof as a mace with my watch. When I was under the roof with the mace is called an avi avos hatumah. I descend one level. I become an avatam. If you then touch me, now I need sprinkling of the waters of the Paraduma. I need at least 7 days on tummy. If you've never become tummy and you touch me, you become tummy also, but you're only a Rishon L'Tumah. You go to the mikveh and at nightfall you're tahor. You touch me. That's if you touch me. What if you touch my watch? You touch my watch, you are now tameh tumas nes 7 days. You need sprinkling of the waters of the Parah Adumah. Why? Because it's exeris hakasav cherev hareyu kachalal. Any kli besides earthenware clay, that's what the Rambam says, or many Rishonim say specifically metal kalim, that which you make a sword of, that comes, is defiled by a dead body, cherev hareyu kachalal. This becomes like the mace itself. Hence, the watch I'm holding, that this watch probably never touched a dead body, but many Rishonim say it doesn't have to, as long as it's under the same roof as a dead body. So this watch has been to funerals. This watch is an Avi Avos Hatzama. Do we have any Kohanim in Shir today? I never get Kohanim. I don't get it. Am I sure and why you? I have one. I have one Kohen.
If I were a Kohen, I wouldn't want to come to the Shir at all.
There is one Kohen on, but he didn't identify himself, so I won't out him.
So that's fine. So I'll ask the following question: can that Kohen touch this watch? If assuming that Kohen were tahor,
listening.
Who is that? Is that Miss Arifa?
Yes.
Okay. You're a Kohen?
I'm a Kohen.
So can you touch my watch? I'll even ask you better. I was once, you and your late wife so kindly hosted my wife and myself one of my early Shabbos at KJ, and I was probably, I was wearing this watch, and I entered your apartment. Were you in the same apartment with the mace?
Right.
Is that a problem?
That's why I didn't take the watch.
Okay. So there actually are two deos. Don't worry. We paskin that even though a Kohen can't be metame to a dead person, we effectively, Rabbeinu Tam doesn't like this Mishnah in Smachos, we accept it. We assume a Kohen can be metame to Cherev Harei Kachalal. So Mr. Arfa, when you touch my watch, you're now Tame Tumas Shiva if you were never nitmase before? Yes, but it's okay. It's mutter for you to do. You can't normally enter a cemetery, but you can touch my watch as much as you like. Because this is the kind of tumah that a Kohen is not musar. I believe actually in Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchos Avelos, where the laws of Tumas Kohanim are discussed, that the Mechaber quotes two opinions about this issue, but we clearly paskin leniently. We assume that there's no prohibition of a Kohen defiling himself to a Cherev Harei Kahala. So even though, if you touch my watch, Mehera Yibana Besamikdash, and if you were Tahar until then, and it's true for any of us, you would not have required sprinkling of the waters of the Paraduma, but through this, you do require sprinkling the waters of the Paraduma, even though Kohanim may, at their pleasure, defile themselves to Masmeis, to my watch. So anyway, the goal of a dofe doesn't usually come up for Kohanim. Kohanim today typically do not dance on top of a rose attack. Most of us don't dance on top of our runners, but similar to goal of a dofe, where a Nazir doesn't restart his process over that tuma, if a Kohen then is mutati the mitamik to that, then a Kohen can defile himself to Cherev Harehu Kahalal. Okay. Fine. So that's what Tosfos deals with. I did promise you, and I'll leave you with this particular idea. What is this Golel V'dofek? Rabbeinu Tam claims that Golel V'dofek is the Matzeva. Which is very strange. It's very, very strange. But I believe, I don't know who says this, it might be an Aruch somewhere. To understand what the Golel V'dofek probably were, you have to understand how people used to be buried. I was discussing this recently, I don't know, was it this year? People were typically buried, we were buried in crypts, right? In other words, when you learn the Mishnayos and Baba Basra, and it's dealing with contract law, it's not dealing with Tumas Kohanim, if you were hired to dig graves, how many graves do you dig and how much space? But the way they've been digging is not the way we go. You go to our cemeteries, at least in the United States. They want to dig a grave. The backhoe comes, goes to the ground, digs out a chunk of the ground. You put the coffin in, you put the dirt back in. That's the way we do graves. That's not the way they did graves. They would dig. You might start by digging a big kind of hole in the ground. And then from that hole, you would tunnel sideways, maybe in multiple directions, and you would have these little like hallways or chambers. And then on the side of each chamber, you would dig chambers for the graves themselves, right? You had these tunnels, and coming out of them, you have the individual chambers where they would put the body after a person died. They weren't buried. They didn't have dirt dumped on top of them. And what the Mishnayos and Baba Basra talk about is when you're hired to dig a grave, how many tunnels, how many graves per tunnel and so on, you know, where we don't want the walls between graves to cave in and so on. That's what the Mishnayos talk about. So what is the goal of a gofe? So when they used to bury, as I said, they didn't dump. It's, you know, they didn't dump dirt on top. And today, if you, you know, to quote a favorite movie, you know, mostly dead is not dead. So if you had somebody who you, that you buried, I may date myself on that. Some of you should at least be smiling at that. Princess Bride. So if you have, if today, if a person, you know, let's say they thought the person was dead, and then we buried them. If they weren't dead when we buried them, they will be dead shortly. That wasn't true in the time of Chazal. In fact, this came up a 19th century major halachic fight emerged over this issue. I'll explain in a second. They used to put them in the crypts. What they would do then is they would roll a stone, a big stone, to kind of seal off the entrance to the crypt. That's probably the golem, the stone you roll. And then they would wedge a rock underneath it to make sure the stone didn't roll further. That's called the dofik. And that's probably what goal of the dofik are in the Gemara. Where did it become a semi-modern controversy? Because the Maseches Machlos is somewhere that they would go visit the Karim for like 3 days after the person died. Why? In case the person was alive and they were knocking, would someone please let me out of here? Okay? And they tell the story, there's some brisa, I don't remember the brisas, but I could find it if I looked. There's a Tshuva L'Chasam Sofer that's quoted in the Pischei Tshuva on Shulchan Aruch in Yerodea in Hilchos Avelos of the laws of burial, they quote this particular issue that you visit the Karim because maybe the guy was alive. If that sounds crazy to you, by the way, you should know, and the doctors here can verify this. Sometimes they can detect zero brain activity in drug overdoses. A person that can be literally zero, whatever the checking waves of the brain, there is no brain activity whatsoever. And then at some point, the person wakes up. It's a big problem, actually, in terms of the assessment of the brain death, of knowing a person is for sure truly, truly brain dead. So imagine you got this person who they thought was totally dead. They couldn't detect the pulse. They stuck him in the crypt because they assumed the person was dead. So they would go visit just in case someone said, can someone please let me out of here? So the issue came up that there were those who advocated in Europe that some of it had to do with government decree, that you shouldn't bury a mace for 48 or 72 hours. And there were rabbis who were arguing, because we see from that case, sometimes people look like they're dead, but they're really not dead. So bikuach nefesh, we shouldn't bury them until after at least 48 hours. And the Chasam Sofer said it's ridiculous. You don't bring a proof from like the oddball case. I forget how many days afterwards the person was still alive. That's ridiculous. We follow a rove, and we're not talking about a rove here like 51%. We're talking about 99.9%. So the Chasam Sofer doesn't acknowledge if the government law says you can't bury for 48 hours until the person's been dead for 48 hours, so you can't do that. But nonetheless, we're not concerned. When someone is dead by the criteria we normally find death, we don't say you have to wait further to just to be sure before you bury them. So anyway, that's, I think, the pshat and what Golo Vadofik is. I think maybe the Aruch or somebody says this, that the Golo was the stone that they rolled in front of the opening of the crypt, and the dofek were the stones they wedged underneath just to make sure that that the stone didn't roll away and opening the crypt. Isaac.
Yeah. Going back to Kavod HaBriot, is that a societal construct purely because society doesn't want to see you naked in the street, or is that related in some way because human beings are made in the image of God, or going back to, when God dressed Adam and Chava, because then they suddenly were aware that they were naked. And it also, you know, I relate it to Kavod HaMes, which is more of a respect for the space of the body. But this Kavod HaBriot, what's the derivative? What's the basis of it? Society or godly?
I'm glad you asked, because I haven't really thought about this question. We just, those of us who talk about Kavod HaBriot, we take it for granted. I think its parameters are defined by society. I think the reason why Kavod HaBrios is defined, is so central, is precisely the reason that you identify, which is that human beings are created in the image of God. And I think I can prove that, which is one of the, in your line of work, not your main line of work, in your volunteer line of work, which is Chevra Kadisha, why is it that we insist upon burying a body as quickly as possible? Why is there a prohibition of lo salin nivlaso ala eitz? So the Torah says, ki kilas alokim haloi. Why is it kilas alokim? What is the cursing of God? So Chazal say that one of the interpretations is that when you walk by and you see a human being who's b'dmos diokno shelboro, he's created in the image of his God, and people, he looks like the king, so people make light of the king. So the reason why we insist upon quid ferio, which I think is a quintessential, you know, is the paradigm of Kavod HaBrios, is because person is created b'tzelem Elokim. So I think what you said is, what you're suggesting there, I think is correct. The imperative, not the definition, the imperative of Kavod HaBrios stems from the fact that human beings are created in the image of God. I'd say the definition, the parameters are society defined. I wouldn't say that being unclothed is a problem because human beings are created b'tzelem Elokim. I think being unclothed is a problem is because we feel a sense of shame. Once we feel a sense of shame, once it's poking in our dignity as human beings, and as human beings, we're creating an image of God, therefore, the halacha is sensitive to fetish.
Thanks.
Rabbi, good to see you. It's Mark Friedman.
Yes.
I'm back.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to me, too, but yes.
You too. But I want to understand this. If these Kohanim are jumping over the Aronos, all right, and they do this because they have to greet the king. Now, what happens to them in terms of going back to their avoda in the Beis HaMikdash?
There are a couple of different things here. The first thing is when they go back, I don't know if they're allowed to jump back or they're allowed to go back. Presumably, they have to go the long way. Presumably, there's a way to go around. If they couldn't go back, if there was only route, like there were no other way to go, that's an interesting question. Would we say that they're allowed to come back because otherwise they won't be able to go? Okay, but I'll stipulate that. The answer presumably would be if this was Bizman Shabbat Semitash Kayim, they would have to go through Midirabana and then have to go through a Tara process. I don't know for sure, because clearly outside of the situation of running to green teams, there is a rabbinic prohibition of jumping across the Aronos. The question is, do you become Tame Midirabana? Because of that, I don't know. It's not, the Gemara doesn't hint, and the Rishonim don't say that.
Thank you, Toda.
Rabbi, is Kavod HaBrios, in terms of the societal norm that you just discussed, measured based on those around you, or is it specific to the individual himself? Because if you'll take an extreme example, and maybe it's not so extreme, you take a yeshivish person who would dress a certain way, and wears a certain beged and a hat and certain garments, right? Dresses in a certain style, right? There are things that might be embarrassing to him or affect his psyche in a dramatic way that would be irrelevant to those around him in the shuk. But for him, it's an extreme embarrassment. So where does the parameter come from? The individual? Or from those around the individual?
So my instinct tells me that it probably does depend upon the individual. But remember, obviously, the individual's proclivities are generally driven by what's around them normally. In other words, the truth is, take your example, that yeshivish person in the middle of, I don't know, let's say, Congregation Rina Yisrael, he might not actually feel so strange because the people around him weren't dressed like that and wouldn't realize that it's strange for him. But I think if he were to, so we might not ordinarily proactively act in such a way, but if he would come and say, I am not wearing my hat, I feel so naked here, can I do X that's drabanon? I mean, again, you might say, I mean, depending on what it was, it might be, that person is experiencing, in other words, the emotion is a universal emotion. It's triggered differently for different people. I would think it's dependent upon the emotion of the individual. Chazal are not going to make blanket statements that apply to one person because you just don't, you don't think of that, but I would assume that it really is dependent upon it, when a person is experiencing a sense of shame that other, just because others around might not, I don't think that means it's not covered up risk. That's what I would think. It, again, I don't think you'll see much in the halachic. I've never encountered anything in the halachic literature that would have been specific to one person, but I think it might be, you know, individualized, because it's really about the human experience, the pain that, and the shame that a person feels.
I'd like to just add on something that I heard from Rav Schechter once when he gave a shiur in KJ on this Gemara. He gave the example of a bar mitzvah boy reading the Torah in shul and making a lot of mistakes. And he said at a certain point, you stop correcting him because of Kavod HaBrios. And since Kriyas HaTorah is Derabbanan, so it goes by the way the heter of Kavod HaBrios. He did say, you should try to read the Torah again after davening,
okay,
in order to be yotzei. But, and I've certainly followed that rule in shul. There are people, you know, who sometimes read and make a lot of mistakes. At a certain point, it becomes very embarrassing to correct them, even on the major things for which you should correct. There's no question about you should correct them, not returning on trump. But anyway, it's a very vivid memory of Rav Schechter's psak on it.
Yeah.
It's an application. You don't get many applications of tearing off garments in the street because you suddenly find kelayim on it. But this one actually does come up.
Right.
And it also touches on whether people in shul ought to shout out corrections, which is, of course, a real violation of Kavod HaBrios.
Right. Okay.
Excellent cheer. Thank you.
Thank you.